Life is full of big moments. Getting married, having kids, moving into a new home. These are the kind of moments that change everything. And they might have you making changes to things you don't always think about, like your health coverage. Covered California wants you to know that when you have a big life change, you may be able to enroll in health coverage or adjust your current plan. The enrollment window is limited, so to see if you qualify or to find one of our local experts, visit coveredca.com today. Covered California. It's more than just health care. It's life care.
Climacophobia, the fear of climbing stairs. It's surprising there's a term for it, but if you have chronic hip pain, it's easy to relate to. But you shouldn't have to. At the Cedars-Sinai Orthopedic Center, our minimally invasive techniques allow many patients to go back home within 24 hours and get back to everyday tasks, like walking up the stairs. More reasons to trust the number one hospital in LA for joint replacements. Call 1-800-CEDARS-1 or visit our website.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcon. You tell me.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, we keep hearing about how we should trust our intuition, but should we? That's not what the science says. My guest tonight, cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Christopher Chabris, is the co-author with cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Dan Simons of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Those bitches are intuitions. About them, Chabris and Simons write that intuition tells us that we pay attention to more than we actually do, that our memories are more detailed and robust than they actually are, that confident people are competent people, and that we know more than we really do, and so, so much more. We think we are so smart, and we really are not. This is the problem. Chabris and Simon explain that in all these cases, our intuitions are wrong, and they can cost us our fortunes, our health, and even our lives if we follow them blindly. Well, tonight's show is devoting to help us all live smarter, and so stick with us to learn from Christopher Chabris where we go wrong and how we can act more like the rational animals we all like to think we are. Hello, Chris.
Hi, great to be here.
I'm so glad you're here. I love your book. And so having a high opinion of ourselves is not in our best interest. And so we wouldn't do so many of these dumb things we do if we didn't think we were so smart and so great at thinking we know the reason things happen.
That's right. It's not that we sort of go around, you know, proclaiming to the world how smart we are, although some people do that. It's more of sort of an intuitive sense we have that we understand and perceive a lot more of what's going on around us than we really do. And I think it's good to sort of understand what those limits are and why they're there and how you might be able to act accordingly in your daily life.
So, and your book is about six what you call everyday illusions that profoundly influence our lives. And these are the illusions of attention, memory, confidence, knowledge, the illusion that we know what causes things, and the illusion of potential, which has to do with the notion that we have these great untapped reservoirs of mental ability that are just waiting to be accessed. And so why do you call these everyday illusions?
Because they can cause us problems all the time in everyday life. These are not sort of special thinking traps that happen just every so often. All day long, we actually think we're noticing more of the world around us than we really are. All day long, we think we're remembering more of our past with greater accuracy, greater objectivity, greater detail than we really are, and so on. These are things that sort of permeate our thinking and our decision-making and our interactions with other people, really no matter what we're doing.
And this is really illustrated. It sounds sort of melodramatic to say, oh, it can ruin our lives, but actually, you open your book with this story. There was a shooting at a hamburger restaurant in Boston. So tell us what happened.
Well, this is a case where someone's life really was ruined. We think because people involved didn't really understand how the human visual attention system works, how we pay attention to things and what we notice and what we don't. So what happened was there was a shooting, as you mentioned. Some suspects fled the scene, and the police radio put out a bulletin, and about 15 or so police cars joined in this chase throughout the streets of Boston in the middle of the night. One reason why there were so many cops involved was that, erroneously, the police had said that a cop had been one of the victims of the shooting. That turned out not to be the case, but in any case, this car that had fled was eventually trapped in a cul-de-sac, and sort of like a conga line of police cars, you know, got into the street behind them. The suspects, four of them, fled the car and scaled the fence that was surrounding the cul-de-sac and tried to get away. And one of the first cars on the scene had an undercover officer. Well, I should say he was not undercover. He was in plain clothes. He was named Michael Cox. And he tried to pursue one of the suspects, a guy named Smut Brown. And as Cox was going over the fence to try to chase Brown, who had gotten over the fence already, he was hit on the head from behind, and he fell to the ground, and he was beaten. And it turned out that Cox had been assaulted by other cops who had arrived on the scene and apparently had not recognized him as one of their fellow officers. And once they realized what they were doing, they all ran away. And in the ensuing investigation, basically no one would come forward to admit that they had been the ones to attack Cox, or even that they had been there to see what was going on. So, you know, Cox, you know, his life was messed up by this. He had to be in the hospital for quite a while and so on, but he recovered from his injuries eventually. The guy who sort of got in a little more trouble as a result of this was a guy named Kenny Conley, who was in about the fourth or fifth car on the scene. And he had seen this Smut Brown guy, who was one of the suspects, on the other side of the fence. And he ran after him, scaled the fence, and chased him down, eventually apprehended him at gunpoint. And in the investigation of the beating of Cox, which was sort of the big mystery here, they, you know, they got all the suspects from the shooting. So the beating of Cox was the big mystery. The prosecutors eventually realized that Conley was really in perfect position to have seen the beating, because he wound up catching the guy that Cox was chasing. So he must have basically run past the place where this beating happened. And they, you know, they interviewed him about it, and, you know, he basically said, "I saw nothing. I didn't see Cox. I didn't see a beating. I didn't see any of this. I was just focused on that one guy."
The thing that struck me in this was that he felt really bad. He said in court that he, quote-unquote, should have seen what was going on. And this is where what you call the illusion of attention comes in. And so should he have seen what was going on? Is it – what was wrong here?
Well, it turned out that Conley, as well as everyone else involved in the case, like the prosecutors who, you know, the prosecutors who interviewed him and then charged him, with perjury and obstruction of justice for basically saying he didn't see anything. They thought that if he had been there, he must have seen the beating. There's no way he couldn't have seen it. Conley himself thought he should have seen it. The jury in Conley's trial thought he should have seen it. There were quotes from the jurors who basically say exactly this. Nobody could really believe that Conley could have been there. He could have run right past this thing and not actually seen it. They thought that this beating must have grabbed his attention, and the only way that he can say it didn't and he can say he didn't see it was that he's lying. He's, you know, sort of maintaining a code of silence among the police not to rat on each other. That was the only conclusion they could come to. And he was convicted and sentenced to 34 months in prison. And, you know, when he lost his appeals, he got fired from the police force and, you know, became a carpenter or something like that. He wanted to be a cop all his life, apparently, but he wound up a carpenter.
So terrible. And you say something that illustrates our prejudice in this, to think he should have seen it. You say that looking is not the same as seeing.
That's right. The mistake that people make often when they think about how the visual brain works is they think that anytime you're looking in the direction of something, or anytime you're even looking at something, you are bound to see it. People sort of equate looking with noticing, or make the assumption that everything you look at, you're going to see. But it turns out the mind doesn't work that way. That's a false intuition that we all have about how the mind works.
And now a journalist on this case, Kenny Conley's case, began to wonder whether he actually might be telling the truth, and it led him to your and your co-author's lab at Harvard, which is where you did this famous invisible gorilla study, which looks at what's called inattentional blindness, the name for this error of perception that results from a lack of attention to some unexpected person or object. So tell us about that study and what it shows.
So Dan Simons was a professor at Harvard, and I was finishing up graduate school when he started. One of the experiments we did, actually it originated as a class project, surprisingly enough. Dan was teaching a class, and I was the teaching assistant, and Dan wanted sort of an experiment that the whole class could do as a group, and he knew about some previous research by Ulrich Neisser, who's one of the pioneering cognitive psychologists, and decided we would recreate that experiment and add some new twists of our own. And so we set up these videos where we had our students be two teams of three players, players in quotes, because they're not really playing a game, but the three in the white shirts would pass a basketball around among themselves, and the three in the black shirts passed a ball among themselves, and all of them are sort of moving around the same space. We set them up in an abandoned area in the university, and they're all moving around passing this ball back and forth. And the idea was to show the video of this happening to people and have them pay attention to one team or another and count in their heads the number of times that team threw the ball. And this would go on for about 60 or 90 seconds. And this is sort of a difficult attention task. You really have to focus in order to do this. You can't pay attention to something else and still make these counts. It's kind of like trying to follow an NFL game. You know, you look away for 1 second, you don't know where the ball is anymore. The trick was that about halfway through the pass counting exercise, we had, in one condition of our experiment, we had a woman wearing a gorilla suit, full-body gorilla suit, walk through and, in fact, in one version, pause in the middle of the action, turn to face the camera and thump her chest and then walk off. She was actually on screen for about 9 seconds. The trick, of course, was we showed this video to people who didn't know what was going on. Told them to count the passes, and at the end we said, how many did you count? And most of them got it pretty much right. It's a demanding task, but one that people can do. Then we said, well, did you see anything else that was unusual? And about half the people said no, and even when we sort of escalated the question to say, did you see a gorilla? They still said no. About half people saw it, but about half the people didn't see it at all. And the funny thing is, the ones who see it can't believe that anyone missed it, but the ones who missed it can't believe that it was there. So a lot of them would say, can you rerun the tape, or I don't believe you, and so on. It really shocks people that they could miss something like that. And this was the experiment that had been published, and Dick Lehr, the journalist who was covering the Conley case, and had originally thought that Conley was guilty because he had covered the Boston police a lot, and he knew the kind of things that the cops would do back in that era. In testimony and so on. But he started to have his own doubts once he found out about this research we did.
Well, I love the gorilla story. And one point you make about it is that we think that unusual or visually distinctive objects will draw our attention, but in reality, they often go completely unnoticed. And this is what you talk about when you say the illusion of attention. We have these false notions of how our mind works, and we think that we, as you're saying, notice and remember much more of the world around us than we actually do.
Yeah, the idea of the illusion of attention is the illusion is the misbelief we have about how our own minds work. We're under the illusion that we're noticing all the important stuff that's happening, and that salient events or things that appear suddenly or things that aren't expected will be the things that grab our attention. In fact, sometimes it's the reverse. Things that are unexpected often don't grab attention. Things that you're more likely to see can often be the things that you expect to see. And in this case, you know, it wasn't just like a little flicker of a little dim flicker of light in the corner of the screen or something like that. I mean, this was a character that walked through, you know, for several seconds and so on. I mean, very unusual, very unexpected, just the kind of thing I think that most people would think would grab their attention. And in fact, Dan Simons, my co-author, and some of his other colleagues did a study later on where they just described the gorilla experiment to another set of subjects who didn't actually participate in it. And they said, you know, if you were in an experiment like this, would you notice? And something like 90% of them said, oh, yeah, of course I would see the gorilla. I mean, that seems to be a pretty pervasive belief that people will see that kind of thing.
Well, I love in that thing, let me tell the rest of their story because it's so funny. This is one of my favorite stories in your book, and you do a great job of illustrating all the science with stories. And I should say who I'm talking with. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Christopher Chabris. He's the co-author with cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Dan Simons of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Fascinating book. This story is so great that I think it was at Harvard in one of the classes, and these people who thought, like, well, of course I'd see the gorilla. You tried a different experiment with them, telling them, okay, we're going to test you, and they came up to a counter. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so this was a similar line of research that Dan Simons was also working on, and I was working on with him. This happened after this gorilla study, I think, if memory serves. On the timeline, this was an experiment looking at something called change blindness. So the gorilla study was an example of inattentional blindness, the idea that when you're paying attention to one thing, like counting the passes in the game, you can be essentially blind to other things, even large and salient things like gorillas walking across the screen. Change blindness is the idea that if something changes in your visual world, even a person getting replaced by another person, you may not actually realize it if you're not paying attention when the change happens or if the change doesn't happen right in front of your eyes. So we set up a study where people who volunteered for the experiment in the lobby of the psychology building then were told to ascend the elevator to the 8th floor where we were set up. And when they exit the elevator, there's a counter about 30 feet away or so. This was back at Harvard when we did this. And they would go up to the counter, be handed a form saying, okay, fill out this form to be in the experiment. And after they filled out the form, the person would take the form from them, duck down behind the counter, and a different person would pop up to, you know, hand them a new piece of paper and say, okay, now go down the hall to continue the task and so on. And, of course, that was the whole experiment right there. The question was, would people notice that they were talking to a completely different person? This was modeled on some other research that Dan Simons had done with his colleague Dan Levin back at Cornell. And, you know, oddly enough, a similar percentage of people, depending on how exactly you run the experiment, 50% or so of people often just don't notice that they're talking to a completely different person. And, you know, there are limits on what you can change, right? It doesn't seem to work to change a man into a woman or vice versa. But, you know, replacing one person who looks like a graduate student with another person who looks like a graduate student, even if they're wearing different clothes and they're different heights and their voices sound different and so on, as long as they're like the same kind of person, you know, like a graduate student, a professor, you know, whatever the category might be, a lot of people seem to not realize at all they're talking to someone different. Now, what you mentioned is that there's the people who were sort of fooled on this. Some Harvard students apparently had just come from a lecture where this research was alluded to, not this exact experiment, but, you know, inattentional blindness and change blindness were mentioned in that lecture, and they volunteered for the experiment and still managed to miss the change afterwards, even though they had sort of just heard about it. So it's not something that just sort of, you know, being a pretty smart guy like a Harvard student or, you know, taking a psychology course or something doesn't really inoculate you against this. These are features of the human mind that sort of pop up, you know, when we don't want them to.
And you emphasize what I like about your book, The Invisible Gorilla, is that you offer solutions and you say it helps us to recognize our limitations. If they had thought, oh, I have this limitation, maybe they would have been more likely to notice the change, especially since it was the subject of the study. And I just wanted to say also, I was going to say, your research, what I like about your research is that a lot of it resembles practical jokes.
Well, that's true. Some of these kind of things have been done on Candid Camera and other shows like that. And of course, magicians are, you know, they're not practical jokers, but they're people who really excel in appreciating on a very practical level, not necessarily an academic level, but on a practical level, what people pay attention to and notice and how to manipulate that. So it does really lend itself to sort of fun research when you can connect with that kind of thing.
Yeah, it really reminds me of how magic, quote-unquote, works. And I just wanted to go back to one more story that really illustrates this how hard it is for us to notice the unexpected. And it's a story you tell about a nuclear submarine and a fishing boat. So tell that story.
Yeah, so this was a one thing we try to do in the book, as you mentioned, is we try to show how inattentional blindness and the illusion of attention and these other illusions play out in everyday events, ones that people have heard of and some that people haven't heard of. This was one that sort of everybody had heard of at the time, but nobody really remembers anymore. Very beginning of the Bush administration, a U.S. nuclear submarine operating out of Hawaii mistakenly surfaced right into a Japanese fishing boat. In fact, it was, a fishing school boat. You know, they were teaching people to be professional fishermen, and split the boat in half and sunk it with deaths and injuries as a result. And where inattentional blindness comes in is that the captain of this boat was very experienced. You know, they don't send out, you know, rookies piloting nuclear submarines. And he wanted to do a maneuver to impress some guests who were on board. And so he surfaced and looked around with the periscope to make sure everything was clear. Didn't surface, but he came up high enough to look with the periscope to make sure everything was clear, didn't see anything, and then basically, you know, sort of launched his submarine out of the water for a fast surfacing and came right into this ship that was right nearby. And he said afterwards he didn't see it. He looked around and he didn't see it, but in as much as he hit it, it had to have been there.
Right. So you're saying that it was in his field of vision, but the ocean's a big place, and you're not used to. Okay, we're going to stick the periscope up. Oh, there's a boat. So he wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, I think there was a very long NTSB report on this, like a 60-page investigative report with all kinds of data. And I think one of the problems was that nobody was expecting this Japanese fishing boat to be in that area. It just wasn't. It probably wasn't a routine occurrence. It wasn't something they had planned for. And again, you know, it's kind of the irony that what you don't expect is often what you don't notice, whereas what you do expect is what you notice. And I think it illustrates the power of expectations to determine, you know, what we perceive and what we conclude and what grabs our attention.
Now, a really important argument you make about attention and the realities of it is you actually you make an argument really that's compelling against cell phone usage by people driving cars. And after reading your book, The Invisible Gorilla, I really have to rethink my own earbud usage because, well, people believe it's safer to talk on a hands-free phone than a handheld phone. And you say this. You know, this underlies the driving law in California and probably laws in many other states, but you say that experiment after experiment has shown no benefit whatsoever for hands-free phones over handheld ones, and that, in fact, the laws may have the ironic effect of making people more confident that they can safely use a hands-free phone while driving.
Yeah, so the illusion here partly is that the reason why it might be unsafe to talk on the phone while driving is that it takes away one of your hands. But I think, in fact, if we reflect on it a little bit, we realize that it's, you know, driving with only one hand is not that, you know, is not that hard. But what's harder to reflect on is the fact that driving with a portion of your mind occupied on something else is very hard. And one of the ways it becomes hard is when non-routine, unexpected things happen. Because it's exactly at those times when the gorilla experiment shows that the more of your mind is occupied with paying attention to something, whether it's counting passes or keeping up a conversation on a crackly phone line with someone 1,000 miles away, the more of your mind that's occupied with that, the less likely you are to notice unexpected events. And when driving, that unexpected event could be someone braking in front of you suddenly or a child walking out into the street or any one of a number of things that, you know, you'd really hate to miss.
And now you say talking to a passenger in your car is not nearly as disruptive as talking on your cell phone.
Yeah, we think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the passenger has a much clearer communication with you. We don't really realize that cell phones are wonderful technology, but the signal is not as good as someone right next to you. You know, it's just not as clear, so it takes a little bit more cognitive effort to pay attention to it and process it. Also, the person sitting next to you is aware of what you're doing, of whether you're in a school zone or you know, parallel parking, or conversely, whether you're on the open road with no other traffic around, and can sort of, you know, slow up, speed up or slow down the conversation, not be expecting you to be responding to everything they say, which someone on the other end of the phone line will, of course, expect you to, and you'll be aware of that social expectation, so you might feel even more pressure to keep up the conversation when you should be paying more attention to the road. There are actually a lot of differences that ought to make talking to a passenger less dangerous than talking to someone on the cell phone. Now, there are other dangerous things you can do in the car while you're driving, by the way, like, you know, eating your lunch or something like that. There are many ways we can occupy our attention, you know, holding hot coffee in our hands and not spilling it in our lap. All those things happen. But talking on a cell phone is one that's rarely as necessary as we pretend that it is.
So I want to talk about what we can do about the illusion of attention, but first a little station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Best Brains in Science. My guest tonight is cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Christopher Chabris. He's co-author with cognitive psychologist and researcher Dan Simons of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. I love this book. So, about the illusion of attention, you say one of the things that we can do is to ease up on people who we think should have seen something, like the cop Conley said about himself, realize that even though it was right in front of their face, they might not have seen it.
Yeah, you can't give everyone a free pass every time they say they didn't see something, right? I mean, it starts to become tiresome and not credible, but you do have to take into account the possibility that sometimes when people say they miss things, even salient things, they're actually telling the truth. I don't know whether, in Conley's case, a defense of inattentional blindness would have been worth the reasonable doubt or whatever, but I think it certainly would have been reasonable for the jury or even the prosecutors and the people who brought the case to understand about that. Now, it turns out that, you know, the Gorilla experiment was being done 3 years after the Michael Cox beating happened, so it was sort of during all this whole legal proceeding. But going forward, it seems like it's reasonable for the legal system to take that into account, and for us to take it into account in our everyday lives. I have to say, we get into a lot of arguments with people over who saw what, who should have seen what. You know, didn't you see the keys were on the counter? No. How could you not have seen the keys were on the counter? You know, and it happens with memory. It happens with all kinds of things where it turns out that people argue, you know, a lot because they assume that other people's mental faculties are you know, performing at a level of perfection that none of us really achieve.
And you talk about how technology can be one way to help ourselves out of the illusion of attention. And you mentioned swimming pool lifeguards and that maybe technological innovations like automated scanning could help them. As does, as I said before from your book, recognizing our limitations and noticing also that the technological aids will have limitations too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a double-edged sword, of course. You know, technology can supplement human abilities. It can do a lot better than human abilities in many cases, right? You wouldn't want to have to hand search the internet, you know, when Google is out there, you know, I'm going to page through all of those pages, you know, and look for everything, right? But on the other hand, we sort of sometimes put our faith in human judgment and human abilities when in reality they're kind of the equivalent of, you know, of doing by hand something that, or doing by brain something that could be done much better by at least a technologically augmented process, you know, so scanning in baggage searches, you know, having computer algorithms pick out suspicious looking items and highlighting them and so on. There are many, you know, opportunities to try to mitigate the fact that people are not going to notice as much as we think they are, and to recognize when we might be putting too much trust in people to notice everything. So it's good to have lifeguards, right? But they're not necessarily going to see everything. It's a complicated, you know, visual problem for lifeguards to notice everything that's happening that's really a sign of danger versus very similar looking things, you know, that are just people playing around and so on.
Yeah, I think that's important to remember. Now, you get into all these other illusions, and just as the gorilla experiment you guys did showed that people see what they expect to see, people often remember what they expect to remember. And you say that memory depends both on what actually happened and how we make sense of what happened. So what does that mean?
Well, there really are, I think you pointed to something really interesting, which are there are nice parallels between The mistakes we make about attention and perception on the one hand, and the mistakes we make about memory on the other hand. We often remember things that we expect to have happened rather than things that actually did happen. So in a sense, our memories sort of change over time to kind of match expectations or stereotypes or, you know, the typical ways events would have occurred rather than how they actually did. That's just, you know, and again, that sort of runs counter to our intuition, because often we think that, you know, remembering a lot of details is sort of the mark of an accurate memory, whereas actually the details often, you know, go away or get changed and so on, and it's the gist that sort of, you know, the gist that sort of stays there. I'll give you, maybe people remember what happened, you know, the last time Hillary Clinton ran for president, now that she's on the verge of doing it again. But the last time she ran for president, of course, it was against, in the Democratic primaries, it was against Barack Obama. And, you know, it was kind of neck and neck. And suddenly her campaign was derailed for a couple of weeks because she had to explain why she falsely remembered being under sniper fire in Bosnia, 12 years earlier. And that consumed a lot of time basically defending a false memory. And it not only consumed a lot of time, but it also made people think less of her, because the fact that she claimed to have landed under sniper fire and was presenting this as a sign of her experience in foreign affairs, in contrast with Obama, who had been, you know, mostly a state senator during the same period of time. People thought she was lying, or, you know, perhaps that there was something wrong with her brain and so on. And I think it's quite arguable that the mistake she made could happen to anybody, that the way memory works is it kind of reassembles fragments into a complete whole. And the whole that it makes is often consistent with how we see ourselves rather than how we really are. So she saw herself, in contrast to Obama, as someone who was really strong on foreign policy, at least in experience. She had been to all these other countries, and so on, and she sort of assembled some fragments into a memory that reflected that, probably, I would think, probably completely unknowingly, and then got caught having to defend it.
Yeah, you know, and I was hard on her on my blog. I blogged this. Hillary calls the Bosnia thing, quote-unquote, a mistake, as in, quote, I got caught, unquote. And I had Carol Tavares, who studies cognitive dissonance, on my show, and she's this respected researcher. I'm a big fan. And she talked about how there was something that she remembered really well with lots of detail, and she told the story, and somebody who knew the details said, that didn't happen. That didn't happen at all. That's not what happened. Here's what happened. And I talked about how I did it. I thought that I made up this line that people say to flashers, that looks like a penis, only smaller. Now, I don't steal people's jokes. I credit them all the time. I was not lying, but it became that in my mind. And it's so interesting how we, so many of these memories, they're aggrandizing. You know, we remember the thing that makes us be seen in the best light, that Hillary was ducking sniper fire, when actually you say that the greeting featured her kissing a Bosnian child who had written a poem. You know, no ducking.
Yeah. Yeah, flowers were exchanged and so on. I mean, it was not, yes, but there was sniper fire in Bosnia. There was a war going on, right? I mean, it was dangerous. A lot of these things happened. They just didn't all happen at the same time, you know,
right.
to the same person. And this kind of thing happens all along. Sometimes the motive for you know, self-aggrandizement could be just having a good story to tell. So you assemble details that make for a good story, and you don't even need to be running for office or anything. You just need to be at a party, you know, trying to tell a good story, and it can happen, right? That this kind of thing happens actually all the time. In cognitive psychology, it's often called a source memory error, because you forget or detach the source of the information from the information itself. So, and this can be as severe as you detach, you know, the source of the sniping information, which was that it was in news reports and probably, you know, she heard about it in the government and so on, from her own experience, and they sort of got reattached incorrectly. I think it happens much more often than we realize, and we shouldn't be so hard on people when it does. Now, when it happens over and over again to the same person, and when they've been told about it, but they still tell the false stories and so on, I mean, then you have something, you know, really much more serious, I think.
Right. I like that you're a realist. You're not just saying, oh, everything's a false false memory, or, you know, it's not really our attention. This is a feature throughout your book. And I'm talking with Dr. Christopher Chabris. His book is The Invisible Gorilla, it's The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. And his co-author is Daniel Simons. They're both cognitive psychologists and researchers. And so you've done a lot of research in this area. Can we ever trust our memories? You know, can we trust that we're remembering things right? How can we?
Well, I think we can, but just not as much. And what we should do is we should trust our memories more when there's other corroborating evidence, just like when you're at a trial. If you're a good juror in a trial, you won't just trust an eyewitness who seems like they ought to remember. You know, you'll look for other corroborating evidence because memory is just not as perfect as we think it is. And it turns out we sort of leave, you know, nowadays in the technological age, you know, there's a lot of concern about privacy and other things like that. But on the other hand, the sort of, you know, we accumulate data on ourselves more and more, which we can use to check our own memories. And we really rarely think of doing that. But when you're fighting with someone over, you know, where you were at a certain point in time, or when you're trying to reconstruct, you know, your memory of what you did at some particular point, there's your sent mail file, there's your saved mail file, there's your calendar app, you know, that you've been using for the last 10 years or something like that. They're your own old phone bills, you know, that people are always using phone records, you know. There are actually all kinds of sort of things we leave around nowadays that can help, that can help bolster our memories. We rarely sort of think of using them. But we can, you know, we can also, I think, we can trust memories often of things that we're experts in, right? So experts have really good memory for huge amounts of what other people would think of as irrelevant and trivial detail, right? A chess grandmaster can remember the exact location of all the pieces on the chessboard after seeing it for just a couple of seconds. When someone's an expert at something, I think that those are people who you should trust more, which is a little bit common sense, but also, it's worth thinking that it's not like memory is a complete sham, you know, that can never be trusted.
Right, right.
It's not like nobody ever notices anything, right? I mean, you just have to, I think, calibrate for an understanding that nobody really, you know, sees, notices, or remembers as well as they think they do.
Yeah, I think that's really important. I love your idea to go to technology, which I do because I joke that I have a mind like a steel sieve. So I often check my iCal and my email, and the problem is just I need better filters. So, now, I want to move on to this fascinating...
Oh, Facebook is great, too, by the way. Yeah, I'm sorry, Facebook and Twitter. You can look at all your old tweets and what you put on Facebook. I mean, you know, we're leaving memories all over the place now that we didn't used to before. So.
Right. No, my blog chronicles my life. I have to look back and see when I did what. So the illusion of knowledge is yet another illusion you talk about. It's fascinating, and this involves, as you say, implicitly believing that you understand things on a deeper level that you do, and it's behind some of the most dangerous and misguided decisions we make. And you talk about how we confuse familiarity from repeated exposure with actual understanding, and you give this great story about a bike.
Yeah, so the bicycle is an experiment that a British cognitive psychologist did. She did a really simple experiment where she asked people to asked them two questions. She first said, how well do you understand how a bicycle works? Basically, sort of rate on the old psychologist's, you know, 1 to 7 scale. How well do you really understand how a bicycle works? And they would give a number. And then she would surprise them by asking them to draw in the parts of a bicycle on a drawing to the best of their ability. And in the paper, she prints some of the results. There are, you know, wonderful pictures where the chain connects both wheels. So it's impossible to turn, you know, the front wheel to steer the bicycle because you'd be bending the chain and falling over if you did. And some of these drawings were made by people who, you know, rode a bike to and from work or school every day. Bicycle, what could be more familiar? What could be more obvious? You know, of course we know how it works. But if you actually sort of push people on their knowledge, they don't seem to really understand it, because if they did, they wouldn't draw, you know, the chain connecting the two wheels, or various other strange, you know, drawings that that they do. And I think it's emblematic of, as you say, this general illusion of knowledge that in a lot of matters we think we know more than we really do.
Yeah, I like how you say in your book, The Invisible Gorilla, that there are no illusions of blindness, amnesia, idiocy, and cluelessness, that our illusions of knowledge, they tend to cast an overly favorable light on our mental capacities. And it's not just that, actually. You talk about our predictive capacities, and this great guy, David Yonts, edits my column. He's this grammar genius, and I like to be very considerate of him. I mean, of anyone, but he's fantastic. And so I'll tell him how long it'll be until he's going to get my column to edit. I write my column every week. I've written now 874 columns. I am always wrong. And this is something you talk about in the book, that people are really bad. And you quote Hofstadter's Law, it always takes longer than you expect, even when you take into account Hofstadter's Law. So why do we suck at this so much?
Yeah, it's kind of a recursive problem. You know, it just gets, you know, it never seems to catch up with what you expect. And I'm, you know, no offense, but I'm not surprised that it's still hard to get it right after 874 columns. I've not written that many things, but I'm still bad at predicting when I'm going to get things finished. I mean, part of it is optimism, right? Like you want to get it finished by this day. But I think often people, you know, or you're saying something for the consumption of others when you know you're not really going to achieve it, but you're just trying to placate them for a while. But I don't think that's really it. I think a lot of the time we really believe it. And you can tell we believe it because we act accordingly. We make other plans. You know, you say your column's going to be done, you know, Monday at 7, and you've got dinner plans for after that you were then going to have to change because you didn't finish your column on time, right? So you wouldn't have made those plans if you didn't really believe you were going to be done by that time. Sometimes this is called the planning fallacy in cognitive psychology. And we sort of classify it under this broader illusion of knowledge, the idea that you understand the length of time it's going to take to accomplish things and other resources involved better than you really do. It's, you know, when it's writing columns and it's just you versus your editor, the stakes are a little bit limited. But when it's, you know, the government investing millions, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars in public works and being off, you know, by a factor of two, three or more, that's much more serious. And I think that, you know, some of that is just gaming the system. You know, they know that if they lowball the estimate, then they'll get the funding, and then they can, you know, get more money as time goes on because you got to finish the thing once you started it. But I don't think that explains the whole thing. I think part of it is explained by a serious, excess belief that we understand the things we're working on better than other people. And one cure is basically to not look at your own project, believe it or not. You know, if you're trying to estimate your own project, don't think about your own project. Think about the similar projects that everyone else has done and how long it takes them, right? So if you're building a building, don't try to estimate exactly how long it's going to take. Look at all the similar buildings that other people built and how long they really took, you know, and then use the average of that or some kind of analysis of that for your estimate. Don't even analyze, you know, don't even calculate it from your own building. Or your own, you know, whatever it is you're writing, your own book, let's say.
Right, and you use the book as an example that you say most of the projects we do are not as unique as we think they are, and that for you and your co-author, planning your book, The Invisible Gorilla, out was a unique and unprecedented task, but for them, you know, it's similar to all the other nonfiction books of this many pages for the publisher that have come out in the last 2 years, and they're used to, oh, authors, oh, we, you know, the dog ate the manuscript, blah, 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 word crash, you know. They're used to all of this. In fact, my editor, who I love, he told me my book had to be in by the 15th of, I think, I don't know what month it is anymore, October, or, you know, it had to be in on this Friday. And then he didn't write back to me. I said, I can send it now. And so when I realized he is so used to authors turning it in late, and I really worked to get it in on time, that he had built it in because he thought he told me on Tuesday after the holiday, I would turn it in on Friday. So I got the weekend. I love that. You know, go ahead.
I was just going to say, they there could be a little bit of back and forth game going on here, right? Like they give you sort of like a falsely early deadline, assuming you'll be late, and then they're sort of actually calculating on what the expected delivery time is. Speaking of publishing, I get the impression there's a lot of slack built into the publishing business. You know, once you turn in a manuscript, there doesn't really need to be a 11-month passage between the time you turn it in and the time the books hit the shelves. You know, it doesn't take too long to print books nowadays. It doesn't take too long
praying.
To set time. I mean, a lot of this
they're
stuff,
praying.
I mean, they build in a lot of slack, and maybe you're pointing to the fact that, you know, they are less subject to the illusion of knowledge about how long it takes the authors to write books. So when the authors turn in the books on time, then they just have to wait for them to come out.
Greg says, just Elmer Leonard's researcher, he says, you have to get it ready for marketing. He just Skyped me that. But I really think, I think that they're actually praying over the manuscript that it doesn't just go and get pulped for a good bit of the time. They have monks come in. So actually, I want to talk a little bit about the people who think that they credit themselves for their successes. And one example was a guy who traded energy futures who had like the most disastrous loss ever. And you say that his successes were due at least as much to unpredictable events like hurricanes as to his understanding of markets.
Yeah, this is a case. This was sort of a premonition of the financial crisis. This happened around 2006, and it didn't really have to do with housing or anything like that. It was just sort of similar to events that would happen with funds completely blowing up after being, you know, greatly successful. This guy was at a fund called Amaranth. And he traded energy futures, and his big success had come from buying gas options before Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, and those events messed up drilling and energy production and so on, and so the price went way up, and he made a huge amount of money because he had made a very large directional bet, essentially, on that. And at that point, he had a lot more money to play with, and he had, I think it's fair to say, the rush of, further belief in himself. And I think that kind of thing can foster an illusion of knowledge. When you, when you make a couple of good high-stakes decisions and you succeed, it's hard to stay modest and humble about your own abilities. So he followed it up with a bunch of trades that completely blew up the entire fund. He wasn't the only trader there, but he blew up the entire fund. Billions of dollars were lost, and it was a big debacle. It was huge news in finance until, of course, the financial crisis eclipsed anything like that. And we sort of think of those things as everyday events nowadays. Guys lose billions of dollars routinely now. And people make billions of dollars, but the making of the billions of dollars is just as much due to luck as the losing of the billions of dollars is. And it has to be. It can't be that all the money is lost because of bad luck and all the money is made because of genius. the luck has got to cancel out on both sides of the equation. So, but we misattribute the success to skill, right, and the losses to luck. And therefore, that builds up this illusion of knowledge. I should tell you one little story. This happened after we wrote the book. Where I live, we have a racetrack for horses, and I had never been. But the first time I went, the very first horse that I bet any money on, I made something like a 30-to-1 return.
Wow.
And I was thinking at the time, imagine how like winning the first one or two or three could really mess with you over the long run, if it convinces you that somehow you know something about this. Now, fortunately, I had picked my horses entirely on the basis of liking the name. So I sort of knew because of the algorithm I was using that there couldn't be any actual knowledge of horse racing involved. But if I had sort of deceived myself by studying the odds and, talking to people at the track and reading all those reports by the tip sheets and so on, I mean, if I had sort of deceived myself into thinking that I understood what I was doing, that could have, that can go very wrong if you have that kind of illusion.
Right, that's a great point, because you talk in the chapter after the one we're talking about now about our illusions of cause, that we like to think that because something happens first, it causes the second thing. But first, I want to talk to you a great tip about stock and as it relates to our overcrediting of our own knowledge. But first, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Christopher Chabris. He's co-author with cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Dan Simons of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. And I love this book because it's about all our irrational behaviors. So on stock, you explain buying stock. You say, anytime you buy an individual stock, you're acting on an implicit belief that the market has undervalued the stock. The purchase represents a claim that you have better knowledge than most other investors about the future of that stock. And you suggest that people see stock buying as a hobby and allocate just a little bit of their money to it.
Yeah, kind of like poker or just recreational gambling or something. Not at all to say that the stock market is like a casino, but just that if we're honest with ourselves about our behavior as investors, unless we are, you know, serious professionals, if we're buying individual stocks, when you think about it, it really means that we are claiming that, you know, we as individuals, with the limited amount of time and knowledge we have to put into studying these companies, understand them better than the rest of the market. Not to say the market can't make mistakes, as we saw, you know, in 2007, 2008, but it's it is sort of, you know, an example of the illusion of knowledge to think that on individual stocks, we have a lot more knowledge. Now, maybe, you know, if you have insider information, then it's not the illusion of knowledge. You know, that is really, you know, that could potentially be real. And it could be that some people, you know, through a lot of study and practice and training and so on, have acquired, you know, true stock-picking ability. We're not saying that's impossible. We're not making some kind of theoretical argument about the way the markets work. We're just making an argument that the everyday person, the average investor, should think carefully about how much he or she really knows compared to the other players in the market before putting a lot of money into that kind of trading.
Yeah, I wish I might before I bought Kukuru stock, which I bought because I like their chicken. And I thought other people will too, and it'll make money, which is really dumb. So let's move on to the illusion of cause now so that we can get out of my embarrassment. This I love. The illusion of cause, you talk about how people create causal relationships from coincidences. And one example you give is arthritis sufferers think the weather affects their joint pain. And this is something called selective matching. And they just focus on days when low weather pressure and pain coincide, and then neglect the rest when it doesn't coincide. We love to do this.
Yeah, I should say that the example of the arthritis is probably a little bit more complex and controversial than we presented it in the book. That would be one of the few you know, paragraphs or two that I might go back and rewrite sometime if I had the chance. But I think it's safe to say that what people do regarding arthritis and weather is they form very strong beliefs about the relationship on the basis of a sort of an invalid process, in the sense, as you say, that they will remember times when there was, let's say, extremely humid weather, you know, rain, and they had a lot of pain that day or something like that, and they will, you know, forget all other occasions except the occasions that were sort of really salient on both of those dimensions, pain and weather, and construct an explanation accordingly. And this happened in the medical profession. You know, they advised people for a long time, you know, go to Arizona or something like that. I don't know that that's actually really based on, you know, any kind of solid evidence. Certainly evidence, you know, not as solid as the kind that you would need to get a drug approved, you know, by the FDA or something like that, you know, but the prescription of move your life to Arizona, you know, I think was based on less evidence than that. It's an example of also something sometimes called illusory correlation. You see things correlating with each other because of a couple of salient examples where they went together, and you sort of forget all the times that they didn't. A classic example is, you know, you're thinking about some friend, right? You know, some old friend you haven't heard from in a while, and then suddenly the email pops up on your screen. You know, wow, you know, that's, you know, you think that there's some kind of relationship. Their entire self-help genres, you know, million-dollar careers have been built on this mistake. Because we don't think of all the times when, you know, you're not thinking of that person and the email doesn't come, or you're thinking of that person and no email comes, you know, or people email you out of the blue and you weren't thinking about them. There's so much more in life that we don't really pay that much attention to bring it back to attention. We form our causal beliefs often on the basis of just a couple of things that caught our attention that seemed surprising.
Now, you just did something that I love. You exhibited something that I think suggests good science, which is saying, look, I'd like to go back and fix something in the book. I don't think this is quite good enough. And you talk in the book, we didn't really get to this, the illusion of confidence. And one bit of advice you give is that, you know, to look for those doctors who are able to say, I don't know. And you say doctors appear confident, but sometimes that confidence isn't backed up with anything. And you actually told a story of this doctor who said studies backed up what she said, but there were none.
Yeah, that was a story that happened to someone else who wrote about it later. But he was a candidate for some kind of surgical procedure, and you know the surgeon said, well, this is what you need, and you know he sort of played he did something which often patients don't do, But they should probably do a little more of, which is they should probably say to the doctors, what's the evidence for that, or what are the alternatives, and what's the relative evidence for them? And you know, doctors who are really, you know, who are really good should be able to explain that and give convincing answers. And this doctor, according to the story, basically went so far as to say, well, there are peer-reviewed clinical trials, et cetera, which support her treatment, but she couldn't actually produce them. And the patient himself couldn't find them, and he was an academic, and he knew how to search medical literature and so on, and he couldn't find them either. So it almost seemed as though she was sort of, you know, the surgeon was sort of prescribing the treatment more on the basis of confidence than on the basis of evidence. And we always would like our doctors to be confident, right? You don't want to go to the surgeon who says, well, I'll give it a shot. You know,
right,
when they're going to cut you open, like, well, we'll try, you know, we'll give it a shot or something like that. It doesn't really feel that great. But sometimes that guy might actually have a more realistic, you know, understanding of how likely it is to work. And then you can make a decision on a more accurate basis.
Yeah, I'm advised actually by an epidemiologist who tells me things about this. He looks at the dark side of things, the glass broken on the floor, not even half full. And he said, I had a problem with anesthesia. I lost my cognitive ability for like 3 weeks. And I mean, I don't really do too much other than write. I'm not that capable. I was really worried. And he said, whatever they gave me, fentanyl or something, he said, oh, for like 99.999% of the people, you know, it's fine, no big deal. And then they just don't talk about those other people that, you know, lose their brains, you know, like they're somewhere else for 3 weeks. And that's the thing to remember. And that, you know, it's great advice to say, to look for a doctor who will, and ask them to say, okay, well, what is the evidence? Because, for example, this advice that made everybody really enormously fat and diabetic to eat a high carb, low fat diet, that's hearsay based medicine. It's not based in good studies. And if people had asked, well, what's the evidence? I mean, maybe they wouldn't have gotten something they could understand, but maybe they would have.
Well, a lot of, you know, it's one thing people often don't realize is that the gold standard for, you know, efficacy in medicine and should be the gold standard in a lot of other areas like public policy is a randomized controlled trial or a randomized experiment. And that's kind of like a technology that humans only invented around 100 years ago. I mean, nobody even knew about doing a randomized clinical trial before 100 years ago, and it was only about 50 or 60 years ago that even the FDA started requiring that for drugs to be approved. Maybe it should be required before diets get recommended, you know, or at least authors of or consumers of self-help books should look for the evidence in favor of them. But it's not something that occurs naturally to people, and a lot of the medicine and the other treatments we have in existence are sort of based on clinical experience, not randomized experiments. And clinical experience, can conceal a lot of biases and illusions and conclusions that aren't really warranted.
Right, that's a problem, and you talk about that in some of the video game research. And so one thing, it's important to find a body of work, that there's the same finding, but the average person can't do this. But you can find some bloggers, some science bloggers. Dr. Michael Eads has come on the show. He really lays out, when he looks at a study, what's wrong with it, what's right with it. And so people who do that, who take off the study's clothes and show you its underwear, you know, you can at least see where their opinion's coming from, rather than the doctor as the almighty, you know, just saying, oh, trust me, there's some studies, and then PubMed has zero. So
sometimes you don't want to look underneath the underwear. You want to sort of keep it at the underwear level, right?
This is,
you know,
true.
It's kind of like you don't want to see how the sausage is made. Well, you don't want to see the sausage at all in this case, right?
Right, no, this is...
I think there are some good guides actually out there, you know, to sort of how to think about research studies and what different kinds of study designs are and what they mean. And unfortunately, there's, you know, given that a lot of people have incentives to, you know, to spin things one way or another or to not notice, you know, flaws because they like the results and so on, unfortunately, there's no real perfect substitute for becoming more informed yourself and understanding a little bit more about how science works before you go following the edicts that are presented as the word of science. You need to understand a little bit more about it yourself, I think.
You're absolutely right. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Christopher Chabris. He's a co-author with fellow cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Dan Simons of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. It's a book we've been talking about. It's fascinating. And you're really good in your parts in the book about where you tell people about, look, this research, there isn't enough, and people need to be more skeptical like that. And so speaking of skepticism, we just have a couple minutes left. Can you just give us some final thoughts about our illusions and how to overcome them and maybe be the rational animals we claim to be?
Well, I guess one thing I'd say briefly is that I'm not sure it's irrational to be the victim of most of these illusions. You know, one reason why we have inattentional blindness is because we're very good at focusing attention, and focusing attention helps us a lot. You know, there are lots of things we can do when we pay attention that we can't do when we don't pay attention. So it's not as though these are sort of pure weaknesses. They're often the byproducts of other strengths that we've built up. So it's not sort of completely irrational to fall victim to these things. It probably is irrational, or at least inadvisable, to sort of not think about them and not be aware of them anymore. Once you can be aware of them, then you can take them into account. And especially, I think, even if you can't see them so much in the behavior of yourself, sometimes it's easier to think about them in other people's behavior. You know, don't get into big arguments with people over who said exactly what 3 weeks ago, because nobody remembers it accurately, right? You're both wrong. But you're both overconfident about your memory. Neither of you are right, and you are just wasting time arguing about it. You know, go to the email or just forget about it and move on and make a new deal, you know, without worrying about what was said. And likewise for what people noticed and pay less attention to how confident people are and better, more attention to other indicators of whether they might be right. Think twice, I guess, is really one way of summarizing. You know, think twice before you jump to any conclusions, especially about important decisions, jury verdicts, you know, buying houses, you know, things where really a lot is on the line. Think twice.
Thank you. This has been just a great show. My guest tonight has been Dr. Christopher Chabris. He's a co-author with fellow cognitive psychologist and researcher Dr. Dan Simons of The Invisible Gorilla, How Our Intuitions Deceive Us. Chris, thank you. What a great show.
Thank you for having me. It was fun.